Hi, I'm Jim Shear, host of 180 Degrees, a podcast brought to you by the Sustainable Energy Authority of Ireland. In this series, I talk to climate leaders about how they first connected to the urgent need for climate action. We go back to their roots and talk about their journeys, discover what drives them and what keeps them motivated. We also explore the essential ingredients required for leadership on climate action here in Ireland and how we might impact internationally. Nothing short of a societal movement is now needed to ensure a livable planet for our children and future generations. In the words of my guest today, Mr. Davy Phillip, to make sense of the world and respond to the challenges we face in meaningful ways requires us to think differently. Davy Phillip is a facilitator and a trainer with a focus on community resilience at cultivate.ie and a network weaver at the European Network for Community-Led Initiatives on Climate Change and Sustainability. Davy was a founding member of both Faster and Sustainable Projects Ireland Limited, the company behind the Eco Village project in Clochjordan, County Tipperary, where he now lives. In this episode, I talk to Davy about life in the Clochjordan Eco Village, its establishment as a living lab demonstrating how we might live in a climate change world. Stay tuned for this fascinating conversation where we imagine what might be possible if we all come together on climate action. Davy Phillip, very grateful to be speaking with you today. We're here in Clochjordan Eco Village in Tipperary. For those of our listeners who are hearing you for the first time, could you start by telling us what you do and who you are?
Thanks, Jim. It's great to be here. So I'm Davy Phillip. I'm Scottish. I've lived in Ireland for 28 years. I came here to study in 96. I studied anthropology and philosophy at Maynooth University and got into sustainability. And I suppose since 97, I have focused on sustainable communities. I was one of the founders of FASTA, the Sustainable Economics Foundation, in 98. In 99, I was one of the co-founders of Clochjordan Eco Village, where I'm based now. And in 2000, I set up the Sustainable Ireland Cooperative. And we ran the Convergence Festival in Temple Bar, Cultivate Sustainable Living Centre in Temple Bar in Dublin. And then we took over the Enfo building with the UNESCO and ran it as the greenhouse for a few years before we moved our whole cooperative to Clochjordan. So we've been here since 2011, I think, and we now run the We Create Enterprise Centre in the middle of Clochjordan Eco Village.
That's a pretty impressive rap sheet. We're going to get into a lot of what you just talked about and explore some of those projects. Could you go back, first of all, though, to maybe when you were a young fella, or do you remember a time when you got connected to the planet or to environmental work? Was there a particular moment in time, or did it come on you gradually, or how did that pan out?
It's an interesting question. I had a sort of a different upbringing than most people. Until I was 28, I was a professional skateboarder. I got to travel the world riding my skateboard and getting paid to wear Converse shoes. And so I had that experience until I was 28. I started a skateboard clothing company and a surfboard, snowboard, skateboard shop, which is still going in Glasgow. But I got disillusioned with that when I was 28. And I went to India for a year and a half to study meditation and yoga. And it's really through there, again, a taste of interbeing or oneness, in a sense, if you like, that really helped me sort of see sustainability in a different way, in a whole systems way. So when I was in university and Richard Douthwaite's book was on my reading list, who's an ecological economist, I really got it and resonated with his whole system viewpoint. And I realized he lived in Ireland. I called him up. We met. We became friends. I worked with him for 10 years. And I think that sort of globally informed but locally active approach to sustainability, which now I would frame more as community resilience or how our communities cope in these challenging times. So it's sort of underpinned my work, that experience or taste of the oneness in India, which sounds a bit too woo-woo, I would say, for me, even myself. But it really resonated when I saw Richard's work, and that's what really motivated me since 98 till now to just focus on sustainable community and sort of encouraging different methodologies, community-led approaches to meeting our needs.
Got that. And we're going to go in again to some of those topics you mentioned, communities and resilience. But just to stay with the individual for a moment, was it that connection to self that really, how important do you see that as part of the journey? It sounds like you started there and it went from the a self-connection?
Well, I am now more convinced that the way out of this ecological and climate emergency that we have is in, that the our interior condition, the way that we think, the way that we engage with others is going to be the determining factor whether we're successful at meeting our climate goals or even making our communities fantastic, vibrant places to live. We are going to have to start with ourselves. But let's not end there. We're gone well beyond the power of one days. We need to be thinking, how do we do this collectively? How do we do this in our local places? How do we now, in a just transition, engage people that aren't interested in these environmental or sustainability approaches and agendas? So there's a big challenge, I think, and it just takes us beyond the individual, but we have to start there. We have to start as ourselves and then think about our relationships, connections in our local places, and especially now the relationship and connections to the nature and environment around us.
So, of course, we're meeting, and you teed it up well, in the midst of a climate crisis that's happening now, a biodiversity crisis that's happening now. Where are we starting from? So how do you see from where you're standing now? If we were starting today, how do you see the landscape of climate action and sustainability now?
Well, anyone that's aware of the science or keeping up with the latest reports on the state of our planet will realize we're in a very tricky situation, and we should have started decades ago. But we are where we are. We need to rapidly decarbonize, get off fossil fuels, and build the resilience of our local areas to be able to cope with the disruption we're locked into. So most of my work is really focused on adaptation rather than mitigation, although I am convinced that we need to be doing both at the same time, both mitigating and reducing our climate emissions, but also building the resilient capacity, the capacity of our local places to feed us, to power us. And we could be doing a lot more locally than we are to shorten very vulnerable global supply chains. We could be growing a lot more of our own food. We could be thinking of our neighborhoods and moving even beyond our individual houses and thinking into thinking about our communities, our places, getting a sense of place, getting a pride of place, getting a awareness of that place, and changing the relationship to the food producers, the farmers, the energy providers in that place, and even becoming food producers and energy providers ourselves with the promise of the rooftop revolution, or people now seeing the potential to grow some of their own food or join a community-supported farm or a local food initiative.
It's a very rich answer. There's so many great ideas in it. So we're here in Clochjordan Eco Village in Tipperary, and when I arrived, the place was a hive of activity. You've a camera crew outside. You were on an EU webinar with partners. Could you start by saying what's going on here in Ireland at the Clochjordan Eco Village for people who aren't aware of it? What's happening here?
Well, the Clochjordan Eco Village started its journey in Dublin. A few of us were involved in activism, I suppose, and involved in Dublin Food Co-op and getting into sustainability for the first time. And realizing that if we had somewhere like an eco-village that people could visit, that people could come and do a course, go back to their own community and apply some of the approaches that we pioneer here, then we might be able to accelerate the journey to sustainability. So there's a lot going on in the eco-village. There's now 55 high-performance houses. We've got our own community-supported agriculture project, a community farm. There's amazing research gardens and allotments for people to grow food and experiment on how we best grow food. We have a community amphitheatre, a 300-seater community amphitheatre. We planted 17,000 trees in our community woodlands, mostly native, although we have put in some sweet chestnut as the trees are marching north for climate change, that trees and vegetables that flourish in other places will potentially do here well here. So there's some sweet chestnut in our woodlands. And we're talking from our enterprise centre we create. And our enterprise centre is really trying to show some digitalised approaches. So we have one of Ireland's only fab labs, a digital fabrication lab, where you can share plans across the internet and make things locally. with digital fabrication, computer-controlled machines like laser cutters or milling machines or 3D printers. We have a food hub, which, yeah, they're out there making a film on just now, which has an online farmer's market to enable a local food economy and connections to local food producers. We have co-working, which you see in the cities, but now that we realize we can work anywhere, let's have co-working in digital hubs like this, rather than being isolated in our kitchen working away. So we still need spaces in our towns and villages, in our city neighborhoods, where we can work together. And then we do a lot of events here, conferences, training, workshops. So we're really experimenting now with our digital studio, where we can distribute events. We can have the speakers and facilitators here with a room of 40 people, but we could have other rooms of 40 people connected to those same events. So we're exploring distributed events or blended events and training. So that's our enterprise center. I mean, it's got maybe 10 or so businesses from the eco-village or researchers or eco-villagers or live in Clock Jordan that work here. So there's a lot going on in the eco-village. It's very complex and it's a rich experience, but also, as you would imagine, with so many people engaging with each other, it can be challenging also. It's definitely no utopia.
Yeah, complex and but there's a real vibrance about it as you talk about it. And even we took a walk around the village, and we ended up in the main street of the town, and we bumped into others who were involved in different projects, and we could see old buildings being revitalized and a real energy in the town. And so you've ended up with a complex system and a society, but what were the key ingredients that it took to get here? Can you list some of those off?
Yeah, I think in 1999, when we started this project, we imagined ourselves buying a farm and building a new village. We spent a year with consultants and architects and building our community. And we realized there's so many towns and villages across Ireland that actually we would be better placed to find land adjacent or in one of these villages and play a part in the rural regeneration. So unlike most eco-villages, we're actually an eco-neighbourhood of Clock Jordan, a very progressive little village that when we found the land here in 2003, it was down to about 550 people in its population from a heyday of maybe 2,000 people. And actually the local community came and lobbied us in Dublin and said, there's land here, it'd be fantastic if you bring your project here, it would keep shops open, it would keep the train station open, it would keep the post office open. So there were a very forward-looking little village or town. In the last census, the population was up to 850, and I reckon it'll be getting close to 1,000 now as people move here because there's something progressive and vibrant going on. So it's an exciting place to live.
It really seems that way. You know, I got a sense that in Cultivate there, you were in Temple Bar. There was a lot of meetings. There was a lot of talk on the talk. And you're out here now in Clock Jordan, walking the walk, you know, and putting this in place. What did it take to take that step? Was it just the call from the community out here, or what gave you the confidence to step out of the ideas and into the action?
Well, I think the forming as an educational charity, Sustainable Projects Ireland, is the educational charity vehicle that's developing the Ecovillage. This was, remember, pre-economic downturn. So we found the land and applied for planning permission and bought it in 2004. The first houses didn't go into 2009. So in that period, the economy started to have challenges. And, you know, in 2009, we had deposits on all of the 132 sites that we have here. By that time, people were saying, oh, I'm in negative equity. I'm going to have to leave the project, lose my deposit, not be able to move to Clock Jordan from one of the places across Ireland. So we've really suffered since that downturn. And then in recent years, the project's got a problem with wastewater. So Irish Water haven't upgraded the town system, meaning that the whole town can get no more planning permissions, which means that even although we have 130 sites, a huge demand of people want to come and join us. For the last 5 or 6 years, we've not been able to expand for a reason outside our control. So with the whole town now, we're looking at other options, ways that we might even test a prototype, new zero discharge or nature-based wastewater systems, or pilot or validate these neighborhood infrastructures. and get moving again. But right now we're a little constrained here and it's difficult to bring new people in.
You're starting now to talk about some of the challenges and some of the ceilings against which you're bumping up against. Can you say a little bit about the bottom-up nature of the creation of Clock Jordan?
Well, I think a community-led approach is always going to be challenging because our communities are full of people with different worldviews, different politics, and different outlooks in life. So when you bring people together, you got to have some good processes or structures or ways of making decisions that engage everyone. And that's been challenging, to find those, to maintain them, to keep the governance good. We're an educational charity, so we have to do good governance. But we're also an ecosystem of innovation with maybe 15 different organizations, NGOs, learning providers based here in the eco-village. So it gets very complex. And I don't think we're really educated or uncultured to think about complexity, to think systems. We think quite linearly. We think reductionist ways where we see the parts run, see the rich relationships between parts. So I think this is always a challenge when you're thinking about a project that both addresses complexity and where we're at, but also in itself is complex. How do we start to act like ecosystems? How do we see different entities supporting each other and bringing value to a place or a local region? So we're really approaching this and pioneering a community-led approach. Now, community-led housing is a thing all over Europe. Community-led or community-supported agriculture and food systems are a thing, but they're still fringe and marginal. We need to have these sort of permaculture, regenerative agriculture, community energy co-ops, different community ownership approaches, more viable, supported, and recognized if we're going to make this transition.
Got it. And what has you thinking that's important? I mean, we're clear, we're connected to being in the climate crisis, to needing other ways of being. I mean, you're something of a living lab here, as I see it, you can maybe reflect on that. And as you were talking to your European colleagues, it sounded like you were sharing experiences about what's working, what's not, what are the blockers, and so what do you get out of that process and learning from each other across Europe?
Well, I think it's a rich experience being involved in a more intentional community or a community-led project. There's a diversity of perspectives that can bring real value to a project. Typically, these things aren't as resourced as we could be or aren't seen as valid. And yet, these are the things that the new European Green Deal, the new Climate Pact, the new Leader in CAP, it will all be around a more community, local-focused approach to protecting biodiversity, to regenerating our local economies, to moving away from long, vulnerable, high-impact supply chains, dependent on fossil fuels. Can we unlock at last the potential of the rooftop revolution and get communities generating energy on church roofs, school roofs, and community centres? Can we be making an income for our communities? Can we think about new co-ops that will bring meaningful work to local places and democratise our businesses so that we're not just a worker or a consumer? We're citizens taking responsibility for where we're at in the world and looking for a meaningful way forward. So there is a lot of richness, but there's a lot of challenges, especially for the pioneers that have been working on trying to move these things forward. Now, we've seen in recent years, the pioneers that pushed the energy efficiency and renewable energy. Now this is mainstream. We're going to be accelerating our move away from fossil fuels in the context we're in. But a lot of the community-led approaches aren't seen as something that is useful. And that's not by just the funders or the institutions. That's by the citizens themselves. So we've been doing, with Cultivate or Sustainable Ireland Cooperative, who I work through, we've been doing a project with local development companies to try and help communities see the community-led approaches that could avail of leader funding and European funding. That's all going to be increased for the sustainability, community climate action, circular economy work. In some ways, Jim, it's a crisis of imagination. We can't actually imagine doing things any differently. We currently do it in our neoliberal economic system as just developer-led. Can we do things in a different way? Now, we've got a very rich tradition of cooperatives in this country. And yet, we've missed out or we haven't brought in the new approaches to community energy co-ops or community food co-ops or food hubs or even the new platform cooperatives that we're seeing emerging with the Open Food Network, where we enable local food economies. So we just need for people to see these so that they can imagine doing things differently than they currently do. And so to normalize this, to mainstream them, to bring them out of the fringes and the margins and say these are valid ways that can help us feed ourselves, power ourselves, house ourselves in a different way than just, being a consumer. This is about more of an active citizenship, if you like.
Thanks, David. Yeah, there's a real sense of what you're doing here being a demonstration project in many ways. And like we talked about a living lab, but you posed a lot of questions in there. Can we find other ways of living and being? I guess we're expanding the conversation beyond just the technology change that's needed and talking about almost the system change. Mm-hmm. So when you think about system change, what do you put in that bucket?
Yeah, it's a good question, Jim, especially in this time now where we're putting a focus on just transition away from fossil fuels towards sustainability and the need to engage people that don't normally engage in these things, to bring in the marginal voices and the voices that haven't been listened to. So there's a real challenge there around approaches to dialogue or to think about our urban and rural regeneration in a different way. So we need places like this that are living labs, that are testing and validating new community infrastructure, new models of tenure for housing, so the burden of debt isn't just on our shoulders. And we look beyond the individual house into the benefits of living in a neighborhood where we might have connections or assets that we share with our neighbors, not as we currently have now, where most of the places we're living are dormitories, we watch TV and sleep there, and we do everything else somewhere else. We educate our kids somewhere else. We go to work somewhere else. We entertain ourselves somewhere else. Could we make our neighborhoods, our city neighbors, our towns and villages, vibrant places where we live, we work, we play? We don't have to commute as much. We've got meaningful work right here where we are, and we can connect differently, not just to connect differently to ourselves, but connect differently to each other and connect differently to the natural world around us. You know, have a new sense of place that actually will give us strength.
That's excellent. As you're talking there, I'm really getting that sense of it being an imagination. It's starting from an imagination place, because it's not this isn't a common conversation.
No.
Usually we're talking about, well, there's a build and how do we insulate it and put the thing. You've demonstrated some of the models here. Now we just went up and bought a sandwich from the centre, but in there was a stand with it from one of the local bakers. And you talked to me about supply chains. Could you tell us how that works? And as one of the examples, because you've listed a lot of examples, could you zoom in on that one?
Well, let's go for food, because food is an easier one. We all eat three times a day, so we have a need for a food. We're seeing how challenged our farmers are, especially the small and medium farmers. They're people that we really need to find ways to support. And I think it is communities like the farming community that are really suffering, but are ones that could really benefit if we thought about local economies and local supply chains. So let's look at food. Here in Clock Jordan, we have a rich ecosystem of food providers. We have our own community-supported farm. It's a subscription basis. We all pay €16 a week. There's about 80 of us, and we have two deliveries of veg from a variety of about 50 different varieties of veg we do. But we also, as you mentioned, Riot Rye Bakehouse and Bread School are based here in the Ecovillage. The baker there, Joe Fitzmaurice, is one of the best bakers in Ireland. He's a real bread enthusiast. He makes sourdoughs in a wood-fired oven. And he's really challenging the perspective of growth and development for businesses. He wants to show how a business could be viable at village level, especially a baker. Rather than having for him to supply Dublin or Galway or even Europe, he can supply his local community and have a quality of life. So his bakery is right next to his house. We support that bakery through a bread club. So I support directly Joe's bakery by subscribing to the bread club. So before Joe bakes in the Monday morning, he knows he's sold 60, 70 loaves. He's got that guaranteed cash flow. So we as a community are supporting that local business through this subscription model. We have the same for milk. Now, we used to have that when I was growing up. We get raw milk from a farm 2 miles away, delivered in glass bottles to the door, you know, which is fantastic. We also have the same for eggs. And recently, we've just started a digital farmers market, the North Tipperary Online Farmers Market, in something called the Open Food Network, which is a platform, a user-owned platform, not a proprietary platform that sucks up the value and wealth to the shareholders, but keeps it for the users. And it really gets routes to market for small producers and routes to good food for local people. Now, you could see the benefit for a farmer here. A farmer, after a busy week, who might be organic or have a niche product and come to a farmer's market, has to work all week and then come to the farmer's market with every bit of produce he's got available, hoping it's not going to rain and he's going to sell that produce or he's going to have to take it home and maybe compost it or waste it. With the online farmer's market, the platform has what is an offer. We order on the platform. The platform takes care of the transactions. On Thursday, the producers, the food producers come and there's boxes out on tables that they know which customers have bought that product. So they only bring what's sold. And they can be here for 10, 15 minutes unless we've got a meet the producer session or staying for coffees and teas with, as the consumers arrive. The consumers arrive and take away what they've ordered. So this, although it misses some of the social capital of a farmer's market, it is actually much better for the food producer from an efficiency or time point of view and a route, established route to market. On the online farmer's market, on the Open Food Network platform, a farmer could start his own shop as well on this platform. So it just enables that sort of local economy to sort of start to work, really.
It does sound like it works, and it sounds like there are a lot of benefits to it. On the zoomed out level then, what does it take for those kind of micro projects? I notice here you're also on a district heating network, so the energy side is coming from a biomass boiler, and you're on renewables that way for energy. But what does it take, do you think, to bring this, which if someone's listening and thinking, this all sounds a bit niche, Davey, how do we bring it to normal? You know, are there three ingredients
there? Well,
there's
two ways I would normally answer that. That yes, we need to do what we can to promote these initiatives as alternatives for communities and citizens to get good food. But I'm pretty convinced now we are locked into a food crisis the like we've not seen since World War II, they're telling us. That means that it won't be a choice to establish a new relationship with your farmers or for farmers to grow more food or produce more food for local markets. It's going to be a necessity. If it doesn't happen this year, it's happening in the next few years. So this approach to this transition to a localized approach, we see as an inevitability, not just, I hope it'll work. But I do think it takes a sort of, again, this pride of place that you want to support your local producers or your local businesses because you see a value in having a strong local economy. The more euros we can spend in the local economy, it moves around that local economy, they say, up to 8 times. So you're getting a lot more value if we can establish and enable local economies. Now, obviously, we need to have global trade, and we need that to be as fair as possible. So I think this goes along well with other solidarity food initiatives like fair trade or direct links to communities in other places that might supply olive oil or coffee or these sort of things. So we still need that global market. It's not a return just to the local or to the toil of the way we farmed before. But I think at the heart of it, you actually need people to value the local, to value community, to see that this is actually a response to the climate and ecological emergency.
Yeah, really got that. And you used the food example, and I guess the energy example that mirrors that is probably that Ireland is currently 90% import dependent for its energy needs. Here in the village, you're 100% local.
Well, only for heat, and we need more solar panels, so we're looking at that now. A local sawmill provides a waste product to us that we burn in our district heating system, and it gets distributed around the houses. It's set up for 130 homes. We're only got 55, so it could be actually cheaper for people, but it's a more secure source. But this is our challenge. How do we quickly move away from fossil fuels and into renewables? But now, and at last, we're going to have a feed-in tariff, so we can be incentivized to put panels on a roof. If we don't use that energy, at least we'll get a return financially. And I really hope that we can unlock the potential of community power, that we have a rooftop revolution, that community initiatives and centers and even churches can benefit from getting solar panels on the roofs and providing energy and both capital to their local places.
Yeah, got that. And you, a word that's come up a few times in the conversation, I just want to turn to it now in the context of the power of communities and that local sourcing of energy and food and those local systems is resilience. Mm-hmm. And you've talked about resilience at the human individual level and also at the system level. What is resilience for you and why is it important?
Well, I think we understand the word from psychology and child development. You know, it's really our bounce back ability, that if we get sick or we get bad news, we recover. And the quicker we recover is our level of resilience. So we can understand the word. Yeah, since 2005, the Transition Town Movement, which actually started in Ireland, really put this community resilience at its focus. And it's similar. It's looking at how does this community, how does this local place respond to challenges, be able to look after itself in difficult times. And that's our community resilience. Now, there's a big difference. We don't want to bounce back to the shock that caused the disturbance. We want to take the opportunity of a shock to break through or move forward into a new way of doing something. There's also a new framing around community well-being, which is a really, I think, effective way, because sustainability sounds like something for greenies and environmentalists. Even although with the Sustainable Development Goals now, we get a real sense that sustainability isn't just the environment. It's about justice and equality in society and the economy and jobs as much or as well as the environment. But what we actually need is to move beyond sustainability to a more resilience-focused or regenerative-focused, where we're actually regenerating our systems, our ecosystems, our community systems. We're regenerating because we can't just sustain what we have. You know, so, and there's a need now when we realize how much nature we've lost or the impact we've had in biodiversity to regenerate these natural systems. It's the same for our communities. We've very poor sense of community now. We're going to have to regenerate that sense of solidarity and coming together. So resilience and community well-being, or community resilience and community well-being, I think can be frames that make it safer or more attractive for mainstream traditional communities to move into.
It sounds like a lot of the models are working here, and you're learning how individual systems can be more resilient. For the listeners who are sitting in the bigger cities around Dublin or living in the suburbs around the country, how do these community principles that you're proving here in Clochjordan, how do they apply to the suburbs around Cork and Limerick?
Yeah, well, I think a community project like this, where we're really trying to prototype new approaches to food, new approaches to do things together, that this is valid for whatever, an urban neighbourhood or a rural or peri-urban, suburban neighbourhoods. To me, that's not something extreme that's only for environmentalists. So there's an opportunity here to improve our quality of life. This is really about the good life. The good life, not in the way we've perceived it as status or power or wealth, but good life in the quality of our life, in the quality of our relationships, in the spaces we have to develop ourselves to raise our children. So really it's about good living, isn't it? And I think with, again, this crisis of imagination, we can't imagine what good living is apart from buying products and the status of how much money we have. Can we move beyond that? I hope we can.
It sounds like we're back to the imagination and the need for a lot more conversations mm-hmm. around it. I think it's fair to say that we kind of got through the pandemic in a way that we probably learned some things about being together and working together. Mm-hmm. Did you see anything during that period of time that sort of brought some of the principles that you already maybe had bedded down here in Clochjordan that we could learn from? And
well, I think in the pandemic, especially in the deep lockdowns, if you have green space around you, if you have people that you know around you, so when you go for a walk that you bump into a few people and have conversations, I think that was really important. And people realized maybe they're in the wrong place with the wrong people, and that if we get out of this, I need to be in a better place. So I think there's an opportunity with the pandemic of people rethinking their quality of life. And maybe, well, maybe if I moved to a smaller town or into a rural area again, we could have that quality of life. So I think there's might be an opportunity of the pandemic. But we're also moving into a time now with the conflict where, oh, there could be an opportunity to quickly accelerate into renewables and avoid the dependency on fossil fuels, especially gas from Russia. But there might be the opposite of that, where it's just a drill for victory and we need now to exploit fossil fuel and bring more fossil fuels in and lock ourselves into that. And at this moment, I mean, we started this decade, which we were told was a defining decade for humanity, that if we didn't make big changes in the way that we do almost everything, that we would probably have an inhospitable planet by the end of this century. So I just hope that this catalyzes rather than distracts us from the job at hand, which we have to reduce our carbon emissions so quickly that we should have started 20 years ago when we knew about this. We also, as well as reducing our carbon emissions, we need to build the resilience of our local places to cope with the disruptions that we're locked into. We're not going to fix climate change now. We hopefully can mitigate against the worst of it, but we also have to adapt into dealing with what we're locked into. And I think projects and community initiatives like what we see at Clog Jordan can really help all communities, urban or rural, think about how they position themselves to cope better in that uncertain future.
Listening to you speaking there, you were sort of calling for us to get back to thinking about what we value in terms of what we value, and from the top down, what we valued for so long are economy, GDP growth, jobs, you know, all worthy goals on one level, but if they're against a background of an uninhabitable planet, they don't really count for much. We've talked a lot about the grassroots and the bottom up. How do you think the top down can better support a shift to a revaluation of what really matters, or allow us to do that and have a good way of life?
Good. Well, I think there is an alignment now with the top down, the European level, with the new Green Deal, the Climate Pact, even the new CAP and the new leader programs will put sustainability front and forefront. It will also bring support to local communities, which is much needed. Now, I think if we want to accelerate this community-led approach, which we're seeing even nationally with our community climate action programs, community climate action needs facilitated. So a lot of my work is about building the competency of facilitators, coaches, animators to work with local communities. Now, that role can't just be a voluntary role. We need to professionalize or at least support the catalysts that could potentially, from inside our communities, that could potentially help accelerate this move in that local place. But you're right, it's all about values. Our values dictate our behavior. Trillions that are spent to manipulate our behavior, to consume, to value status, to value power, to value wealth. Not to value community, solidarity, universality, you know, those values are intrinsic.
Yeah, there's a group of young people around the world who are really driving a lot of this, and they shouldn't have to be, but I think they can see it a lot clearer than maybe others. So, you know, we've seen that come to Ireland, we've seen, you know, protests and things like that where, you know, these younger generations are really crying out to us older generations to get our act together and move towards, I think, these kind of things you're talking about, so they can have the freedoms. How do you think we best respond to their call?
Well, I'm so glad for Fridays for Future and the groups like Extinction Rebellion for waking us up and sounding the alarm and declaring, getting this emergency declared. But it's been quickly forgotten, and I think we're selling out the youth. Because we're saying that you're going to have to invent things like carbon capture and storage or technologies we're going to have in the future to deal with our mess. And the proposition for a young person looking at the future right now is there's no doubt that this is causing anxiety. They call it now climate anxiety or eco-anxiety. So young people are losing hope. They're not seeing a future. There's not a future for them like we had when we were growing up or our parents had, where the future was getting better. The future's not getting better now. And we need to look realistically. We need to look this squarely in the face and go, we're not with technology just going to fix everything. We're going to fundamentally have to shift and do things differently. Now, we can design a system that works and is good for us, or we can just think that we can just keep going to infinity and beyond with the technologies we might have in the future. I just think it's more prudent to actually look at where we're at, honestly, and say, well, what can we do? We need to make those responses much quicker than we're currently making them.
Honesty's come up as a couple of times as being really straight about what's going on. You talked about climate anxiety. Are there times when you're down about what's going on around the world when you read the latest reports or the science? And if so, how do you cope with those times?
Well, that's a good question. And I think it all comes back to our inner condition, you know. So I think it's important in a way to have a meditation or a mindfulness practice. It's important to go for walks in the wood and getting out into nature and having that connection for our mental health. You know, so the idea of resilience is not just about new technology or community approaches. It's about really addressing the crisis of loneliness and isolation and mental health challenges we have now that could be dealt with at the same time we deal with climate change if we're smart about what we're doing. You know, so building stronger communities that values care and solidarity is probably as good for our mental health as it is for our biodiversity health, but we need to do them all. So what sustains me, because, I mean, anyone reading the science, there's potential you're just going to give up hope because it's not looking good, you know, and it's worse than we think. And we're so ill prepared to cope with what's about to happen in this decade, even not far away now. I mean, we're already seeing heat waves at the start of the season that are just unprecedented. It's like someone out of a Kim Stanley Robinson novel. You know, this is like what we thought would happen in decades' time, not now. So we need to wake up. We need to tell the truth. We need to look at what we can do as citizens and what we can do when we come together in solidarity to build community. And that can be joyful. So that keeps me buoyant, that we can actually redesign our economy into a well-being economy, which has prosperity without economic growth and debt, where we can feed ourselves and make sure everyone on the planet is fed. You know, we have an opportunity here. Let's not lose it, I think.
Yeah, it's amazing when I hear you talk about what the state of play, just even the sense in the room, you know, and then when you talk about possibility and what you're doing here, I can feel the energy coming back up again. Mm. Could we look to the future then to sort of get towards a wrap-up here? Mm-hmm. What do you see for the future? When you look at, say, 2050 for Ireland, what does it look like from where you're sitting?
Well, I don't think it actually looks much different from what we see now. It's just all our homes will be really energy efficient and powered on renewables. And we'll have a much bigger focus on the neighbourhood and our community around us, not just our individual houses. So I don't think our say, neighbourhoods and towns and villages will look much different. If we get through this and we accelerate this transition, then I could see the potential to have healthier communities, healthier people, better connections to the businesses around us, opportunities to have meaningful work in the places we live, fantastic green space and blue space that is good for our mental health, and our kids are free and you know, not just on computer games, but are out there playing in the woods. You know, that's the picture I sort of see. It's what we are doing now, just a little more cooperatively than individually, and a bit more focus on quality of life than just consumption, and a bit more focus on our community wealth rather than just our individual wealth.
Would you say you're optimistic for the future?
I'm always optimistic, but I'm also a realist. So I can stay optimistic if we keep moving and we accelerate the actions that we're doing now, and that we have more opportunities for communities to do the right thing in energy and food and mobility and transport, and do that in a way that brings real community wealth and keeps the value of our places intact, and make these amazing places to live, work and play in, and that we can thrive, not just survive in this uncertain future.
David Phillip, thanks for your imagination, your passion and your time today.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. We hope you enjoyed our conversation and it's left you in action and hopeful for our future. Please visit seai.ie/podcast for information on each of our guests this season and links to further relevant material to support you around your own climate actions or resources if you are suffering from any climate anxiety. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to 180 Degrees and rate the podcast to help us spread the word.